this is our 11th class on Deuteronomy. This is yet another of the photographs I've been digging up to show you the plains of Moab there in the distance. You can see the hillsides are in the country of Jordan. Just to the right, which is to the south and out of sight of this photo, would be Mount Nebo. That these are the plains of Moab. And those are the ruins here of ancient Jericho, perhaps as much as 10,000 years old. It's been argued, and likely the oldest city that's ever been discovered. It has the oldest structure that we know of, sure at least, that's there, apparently a granary or something like that. But it is in this immediately adjacent area where Deuteronomy is being revealed by the Holy Spirit, recorded by Moses, and then lived and practiced by the Jews, at least, if they will bring them joy and success in this new promised land, Jericho being the first place, of course, that they will conquer. So we have been going through the second law, Deuteronomos, second law, and this is the same slide I used last week. You know, we have just a whole collection in these chapters now that are sundry laws, unrelated each to the other, just like last week. There are so many of these that I'm not going to give you an outline. But Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, is the first section. So we have a statement about divorce. For those of you that are in the Bible class on Sunday mornings, you're probably wringing your hands and tearing your hair. Oh, no more of this, you know, because we've been into this so deeply for several weeks on the mornings now. But there are those who do not attend that class, and certainly there are those who listen to the tapes and all. So tonight, I thought what we'd do is work through Deuteronomy 24 again, use the very same slides that I showed you here maybe a month ago on Sunday mornings. We'll go very rapidly through them, though. And then I really would like to throw this open for discussion. Now, I haven't been able to do that. I'm on a really tight timetable for 1 Corinthians, and so trying to get through a massive amount of material and still finish at a particular time, you know, we're and kind of struggling with that, I have been, and so I've been limiting the amount of time that we have for class participation. But as it turns out, with Deuteronomy, we've really got a pretty well open-ended time frame here. So tonight, let's talk about Deuteronomy 24. Let's open it up for whatever discussion you want. I'll give you some slides from Matthew 19, which is directly related as well. And if we like, then, you know, we can just have a full-on discussion of this. And if we don't get any farther than these four verses tonight, that's all well and good, too. But we'll just see how it turns out. We'll leave it up to you. So first, I just want to read the passage. Deuteronomy 24, verse 1 says, "When a man takes a wife, marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes, because he has found some indecency," in the New American Standard, uncleanness in other passage or other translations, "because he's found something in her, she now finds no favor in his eyes. And he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house. And she leaves his house and becomes another man's wife. And if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled." That is, she's had a sexual relationship with another man. That subsequent relationship sets her apart so that she can't go back to the first man. It's called a defilement. We've talked about defilement a lot, but it's referring to marrying the other man, then you can't come back to the first one. So read verse 4 again. "Her former husband, who sent her away, is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord. And you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Now, as I say, surprisingly, I know some of you would think, for as much time as we spent on this topic, I've been going very fast through that material. And so I'm going to seize, you know, the opportunity here tonight to point out something that I didn't even talk about when we were looking at this on Sunday mornings. Look at this passage. This passage is not about who has a right to divorce. That is almost exclusively the only way it's ever used. But that is not what the passage is even about. Do you see that when you read it, when you look at it? What are these four verses about? What does the passage teach? What is the only reason that it's there? Did Moses receive from the Holy Spirit a message, we need to have a law about divorce and remarriage? No. What it is, what it's about, is these four verses say, if you get a divorce, which is taken for granted, and then the person that is guilty of the indecency marries somebody else, the first husband can never take her back. The passage is there to tell husbands that if you divorce your wife because she finds no favor in your eyes due to this indecency you found in her, you can't take her back. So think twice before you divorce her. You can divorce her. It's perfectly legal to divorce her. She's guilty of this indecency. You can divorce her. But the passage is there to tell them, the lower verses is the bigger part of it, is you can't take her back. Just know, even if her second husband dies, you can't take her back. So it's not a passage that's designed to give us a list of who can marry and who can divorce. It's a passage that says, when you do this which is taken for granted, you divorce a woman guilty of this indecency, then she marries another guy, you can't take her back. If she doesn't marry another guy, you could. But if she has a second sexual relationship, then she's totally off limits. You can't have her back. Now, what I did point out last time, though, is that because of, in my view, a misunderstanding of Matthew 19, which I'll put on the screen here in a little while, one of the more popular teachings among us and out in the world at large is that this is where Moses changes the law of Adam and Eve and the law of the garden. That it's right here where God says, up to this point, you are not allowed to divorce a wife frivolously for less than adultery or for any cause that you want. Prior to this time, you could not do that, is the way this theory goes. But now, here in Deuteronomy 24, God says, from this point on, for you Jews alone, because we're not talking to Gentiles, now I'm telling you it's okay for you to divorce your wives for any reason you want. If you don't like her, whatever this is, no favor in your eyes, then you can divorce her. So there's been many different ways it's been expressed. And some people get mad if you use one instead of the other, but they've all been used. So you will hear it said, Moses lowered the standard. These people rebelled against God, and God then said, well, if you don't want to serve me, then I'll lower the standard. And the wives will just have to get used to it. Used to be, husbands couldn't divorce for anything other than adultery. But now I, in Deuteronomy 24, I'm going to tell Moses, you can't. You can divorce your wives for any reason whatsoever. Now, does the passage say that any lowering of the standards is taking place? Does the passage say that any change of standards is taking place? Does the passage in any way alter what was the standard from the garden? Well, it doesn't say that. I just want to point out, if it's doing that, it doesn't say it's doing that. Not in this passage, not anywhere in this book. That's big for me. If we're going to read another passage in the New Testament, Matthew 19, as we will in a minute, and then we get out of that passage that what Moses is doing is lowering the standard so that now you can divorce a wife for adultery and anything else you want. Just go ahead. Yes, in the back.
Is there any different standard saying that a woman divorces the husband rather than the man divorcing her?
Okay, the question is there a difference between men and women? In the charts that I handed out on Sunday mornings, which are still available, so I'll get you a copy if you don't have one from Sunday morning. In the chart I put together on Sunday mornings, I listed every sexual sin from Leviticus. You remember when we were earlier in this class. And then I pointed out specifically the ones where the Bible expressly says for the man and not the woman, or when it says the man and the woman. And so the answer to your question is sometimes it's universal, sometimes it's specific. It depends on the particular sin or circumstances you're talking about. And then when you get to the New Testament, thanks to Mark 10 in particular, it's particularly demonstrated that a wife has a right to divorce her husband just like the husband has the right to divorce the wife. But it doesn't say that in each and every passage. So you will find, you know, that varying, but ultimately you put them all together, you know, and then you can work it out. Yes?
On the defilement, you make it sound like she's defiled because she's gotten married again. But could the defilement just be the fact that he put her away publicly with her indecency, and that he's told the world that she's defiled? I mean, how can it be any greater than the first indecency that she did?
Yeah, I'm going to total this up in the next slide, so we'll get to it in just a minute. But, you know, in answer to your question, it's very apparent, since she has been defiled, she's been defiled because she's got a latter husband. It's a second husband. She was not defiled so that she couldn't marry anybody. She's not defiled in the sense that because you've done this indecency, whatever it is, therefore you're defiled. It's saying because you took this second husband, you are defiled in relation to the first husband now. Anybody else could marry her except what? Leviticus.
Priest.
A priest. So that also helps us to understand. She's free to marry. Regardless of what the indecency is, she's perfectly free to marry after she's been divorced. But she couldn't marry a priest, and since the priests are told they can't marry a divorced woman, then we know that defilement is not just that she's been divorced, it's that she's had another husband. Priests could marry anybody but a divorced woman, so a divorced woman could marry anybody else. Okay, now, let's just look at this again, kind of line by line. But in verse 1, when a man takes a wife, marries her, and it happens, she finds no favor in his eyes because there's a motivator behind the loss of favor. She has lost favor in his eyes because he found some nakedness in her. And he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, sends her out from his house. That's all just taken for granted. Now, I've introduced this word, nakedness. It's translated indecency. It's translated defilement, uncleanness, depending on what translation you read. What is shocking to anybody who does the research on the words in the original is that indecency or uncleanness ever crept into an English text. It's exactly the same way we say, well, how did pastor get in there in Ephesians 4? It's a Latin word. The word means shepherd. Why did they put pastor? Why did they just translate it? And anybody who studies this does exactly the same thing with this word indecency. The word is nakedness. I've got a whole set of charts I'll show you in just a minute. Everybody knows it's nakedness. And I don't know why they decided to use, in this one place alone, indecency or uncleanness. It's just weird. So I haven't done the textual criticism study to find out when it first started getting translated that way. But the word is nakedness. That's the word. It says he found a matter of nakedness. She finds no favor in his eyes because he's found her in nakedness. whatever she's done that has provoked his loss of favor and the divorce is because of what she did involving nakedness. Now, number one, to subtotal this, a man and a woman properly married. Can we all agree on that? A man takes a wife and he married her. So far, so good, right? In the passage, number one, they got married. There's no objection to it. Number two, she finds no favor in his eyes, which is to say she displeases him. It's just stated as a matter of fact. But then, the reason for it is found, she is stipulated, he found an indecency in her, and that is the Hebrew word for nakedness. So, number four, the nakedness, the indecency, the uncleanness, however you translate it, the word is nakedness. The nakedness permits, allows, authorizes, gives him the legal right to divorce her. He has every legal authority to do it because of the nakedness. Doesn't say the law is being lowered. Doesn't say a different or new standard is coming along. It stipulates only one reason for the divorce. He found this nakedness in her, and now he has a right to divorce her. Jimmy.
So basically, she has committed adultery, so that's a legal reason to divorce her.
That's correct. Okay, so if you heard what Jimmy said, he finds this adultery in her. That is my conclusion. And by the way, a vast number of philological students and whatnot, you know, will tell you, it is. It's adultery. That was the debate between Hillel and Shammai. In the first century, those two rabbis were arguing over this very thing. One said, it's a sexual sin, and the only reason you can get a divorce. The other one said, no, it's for any reason at all. Go ahead.
So they don't have to prove that she, by taking the whatever it is, and then God exposes it?
Yeah, that had to do with a virgin. And nobody's arguing that she's a virgin here. That's a different passage. So it wouldn't be applied here. Okay, so the nakedness allows him to divorce her. He's got every right to do it. But the nakedness also permits him to send her out with the certificate of divorce that Jimmy just mentioned, and they are both divorced. It's not that one's divorced and the other isn't. They're both divorced. And they both may freely marry, with the exception that she can't marry a priest. She can marry anybody else, but she can't marry a priest. Now, brethren, does anybody have any problem with this? Isn't this just what it says? Okay. Verse 1 is the foundation to get to a point. It's not that he wanted to write verse 1 to give us a law about marriage and divorce. He just wanted to establish, when you have these circumstances, here's what you can do. These circumstances happen all the time, just as much back then as they do now. And when they do, here's the conclusions you draw. Okay, Jimmy, again.
So how does he make...
A little louder, Jimmy. My battery's died in my hearing aid tonight. I'm really struggling.
There's not just a few people, like 1,000 people in one area. How do they know that? I mean, like us, we would get on TV and announce it or something maybe, but how do they... tell everybody that they're legally divorced, and he's written for...
Okay, if I'm understanding your question, and I'm deriving it partly from what you said earlier, the certificate of divorce, why does it exist? It exists for two reasons. It identifies her as a what kind of woman? She's an indecent, unclean, fornicating, guilty of nakedness... Portia woman. But it also gives her a full legal right to what?
Marry.
So sure, the existence of this certificate of divorce identifies her as having sullied through sexual activity her previous marriage. She's the guilty party. But it also gives her the legal right to marry anybody but a priest. Let me just add one thing to that before you go, Carol. Sorry, hold the thought there. But, you know, brethren, suppose everybody knew she'd been married for years. Well, now she's going to marry somebody else. Just like in our society, what do you need? You need proof that you're not still married. You got to be free to marry. The whole community knows you've been married. Why are you going to get a second marriage? Well, it's not a second marriage. I've been divorced. Here's the proof. I have a legal right to marry. Okay, Carol.
Jimmy, I think what sort of Jimmy's saying is he's giving her a certificate because he's caught them, but he's only one witness. So he can't take it any further than to give her a certificate of divorce, because if there had been two or three witnesses, she would be stoned.
Excellent, and good for you. And this is coming out of our morning class. This passage exists next to other passages which say, if a person commits adultery and you have at least two or more witnesses, then what should be done? Then you put her to death. But in the vast majority of cases, who walks in on a matter of nakedness with a couple of friends? You don't have that happen. You come home and you catch them. Now you're the lone witness. You can't put her to death. You have no way. There aren't witnesses. So what do? You know, she's guilty. You saw it with your own eyes. This passage authorizes husbands who catch their wives in adultery to divorce their wives. And then they are both equally divorced. They are both free to marry anybody they want, and no law has been altered, changed, reduced, or is at all variant. This is the way I believe it's always been since the garden. Moses is simply stating, remember this, you can't take her back. It's about whether or not you can take her back, and we'll get to that in just a minute. The bill now.
Yeah, a couple of matters relating. I looked at my index and I couldn't find it. The priesthood, I believe, have an injunction that they can only marry within their own tribe. They have to be a member of
the Levites, tribe. Sure.
And there's another place concerning the marriage of virgins, and someone claims there's indecency, wants to get rid of her. Or he accuses her. Her parents have recourse.
Yeah, that's what Jimmy was just talking about.
He's in trouble and she's not.
Yeah, that's what Jimmy was just mentioning. And it does not apply in this case. They've been married. Nobody's arguing about whether or not she was a virgin. He's not saying that. He's caught her in a matter of indecency years down the road. So it's not as a result of the wedding night. We got a different passage for that. Bob?
So she can, even though she's been defiled, she still can go to the priest and offer sacrifice for her sin, can't she?
Sure, she can be forgiven like anybody can be forgiven. Brethren, I only know of one unforgivable sin, and that's blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. A person who commits adultery is not an adulteress for the rest of their lives. And as a matter of fact, among the saints, my experience at least, I think most adulteresses and adulterers are horribly unhappy with themselves, entirely and properly repentant, and they just want to be forgiven and never do that again. So let's remember that. Now, could a husband who has caught his wife in adultery take her back, or let's say not divorce her in the first place?
Sure.
And don't lots of husbands do that? Don't lots of wives do that? Sure they do. The passage doesn't say he has to divorce her. The passage says that if he's caught her in this matter of nakedness, he could divorce her, but he doesn't have to. Either way, it's up to her, Bob, and everybody else, for seeking forgiveness, wanting to make it right. But brethren, I know it makes us wince and everything, but you know, I have to counsel people, I have to work with these people, and some people are harlots. They're just whores. And they're whoring all over town. And they're not the least bit repentant. And now you caught her. What? You can't put her to death because you don't have the witnesses. Do you have to keep her? No. You can divorce such a woman. Is she going to sue for repentance and be sorry? No, she's totally hard-hearted. Maybe she just married the guy for his money or whatever. Now she wants to pillage him. All those things happen. And with that law, when a guy catches such a woman, whether she's repentant or not, he could keep her. He could divorce her and take her back if she never has a sexual relationship with another man. He just can't take her back if she does have a sexual relationship after she's been divorced. Okay, so let's march on now. Here's our Hebrew word translated indecency. In Deuteronomy 24:1, it's the word for nakedness. And it's used 94 times in the entire Bible, 74 verses. 85 times it requires that it be understood as physically nude. 9 times it's used metaphorically, like the nakedness of a land. And that means that 90% of the time it actually means personally without clothing. You've been found without clothing. You're naked. You're nude. In the 5 books of Moses, it's used 45 times in 30 verses. 42 of those 45 times, it means physically nude. And it can't possibly mean anything else. One time it refers to an empty pitcher, a naked pitcher, a pitcher. It's naked because it hasn't got anything in it in this case. And then one time involves defecation in the military camp. And then you have Deuteronomy 24:1. And this is why I say it's just so mind-blowing that indecency ever crept into this text. Why is that there? It's never used that way anywhere else. It doesn't mean that anywhere else. There's no doubt it doesn't mean that anywhere else. Why would it mean that here? So it doesn't mean something short of adultery. It doesn't mean something other than a matter of nakedness. It doesn't mean that I just don't like her anymore. It doesn't mean that her hair fell out or she got fat. It doesn't mean any of these things. It means naked. That's what it means. So 95.5% of the time, it means personally nude. In the 5 books of Moses, there's only 3 exceptions, if Deuteronomy 24 is one of them. Then there's only 2 exceptions. In the book of Leviticus, which we previously studied, here's our word. 34 times in that book, 20 verses. 34 times it means physically nude. 100% of the time in the book of Leviticus, which has been these people's law for the last 39 years. They've had Leviticus to define nakedness, sexual impropriety, for 39 years. They know what the word means. Somebody put indecency in there and messed up a lot when they did. That isn't what it means. When a man takes a wife, marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he's found some nakedness in her, he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out from his house, she is guilty of one of the crimes in the list of 33 in Leviticus. She's guilty of adultery. She's guilty of porneia. He caught her naked in some one of those 33 listings in Leviticus. That's what happened. And they knew what the word meant because they had it defined for the last 39 years in the book of Leviticus. She leaves his house, becomes another man's wife. It is perfectly acceptable for the adulteress to marry another man. It would be acceptable for her to marry another man if she had murdered her husband. It would be acceptable if she was guilty of kidnapping. It would be acceptable if she was guilty of lying and anything else. It's perfectly acceptable for her to marry another man in Deuteronomy 24. She doesn't lose marital rights. Even if she killed him, she wouldn't lose marital rights. Verse 3, if the latter husband turns against her. Now we have the reason for the passage. If the latter husband turns against her, writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, sends her out of his house. If the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she's been defiled. That is an abomination before the Lord. You shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Now I want to emphasize this again, as I didn't do it on Sunday mornings. Brethren, this is case law. A case is stipulated, and then what to do about it is given you. The case is the reason why all the rest exists. All the rest is the reason why the whole passage exists. Because of this case, Then we have the instruction on what to do. The passage was not written to give us a list of cases. It was written to tell us what to do in this one case. When you don't have witnesses to put her to death, but you know she's an adulteress because you found her in it, and now your heart finds no favor for her, as very few husbands would. So, it is forbidden in these verses. It is declared to be an abomination, and it is declared to be a sin for the first husband to take back a wife who has been married to a subsequent man, even if the subsequent man has died. You cannot take her back. Now, I just assert my opinion in this regard. What I'm about to say is my opinion. I believe this is still true. I can find no biblical reason why this has ever been suspended, removed, or changed. Men and women are still male and female. They still get married the same way they did in the garden. Sexual activity still makes them one, and there are sexual crimes that are committed against that union. I personally cannot find, nor do I believe anybody else can, any statement in Scripture which would say God changed his mind when Jesus died on the cross. And what was once forbidden with regard to marital relationships, which are the same before Moses, during Moses, and after Moses, they're the same. It's the same circumstances. It's the same covenant making. What was forbidden, what was an abomination, what was a sin, isn't anymore. And now you should take her back, even though she's had another husband, even though that second husband died, even, you know, whatever. I don't think that ever changed. That's my view on the passage. So, for those of you in the morning class, you know, just know, my whole view on marriage, divorce, and remarriage is this. Whatever it was in the garden is exactly the way it was after the garden and before Abraham. They were just human beings. Whatever was true for Adam and Eve, a marriage, divorce, and remarriage, was true all the way to Abraham. Then God chose Abraham to separate his children as Jews and these people over here as Gentiles. And no law changed. The Gentiles were still under the garden law, and the Jews are too. No law changed. Abraham didn't lower the standards. Abraham didn't say you can divorce for any reason at all. You still could only divorce for adultery. Then came Moses' law 400 years later. Nothing changed. Moses didn't change a thing. Moses' law on marriage, divorce, and remarriage says exactly what Abraham's law was and exactly what it was in the garden. Then came Christ and Christianity, and nothing changed. In my view, not one marital law ever changed. God was consistent. Why? Because he's of the business of loving and protecting wives. God would never, in my mind, and there's no passage that ever says he did, decide that husbands for a little while are going to have a right to divorce their wives for something less than adultery. I can't imagine God would do that. I used to think he did. Now I realize that's just not a divine character. He never changed his law on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. He could change his law on dietary stuff. He changed his law on a lot of things for the Jews that were not of a consistent moral nature that goes to the core of human beings and the vows that they take. But on marriage and divorce, I don't believe he ever changed a thing. So let me get through a little bit more. Leviticus was the law to define nakedness for 39 years. When Deuteronomy says, if your wife is guilty of it, as listed in Leviticus, husband can divorce her, but he doesn't have to. She can marry anybody but a priest. He can marry anybody he wants. She may not return to the first man. That's the law. Now, fortunately, we have a divine interpretation by Jesus for Deuteronomy 24 in Matthew 19. Twice, Jesus will use phrases from Deuteronomy and therefore tell us what Deuteronomy was talking about. So, here's Deuteronomy 24, and I've highlighted, she finds no favor in his eyes because he found some nakedness in her. Those are the two things that are going to be discussed in Matthew 19 that are derived directly from Deuteronomy 24. Pharisees came testing him and asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" When we look at this passage, the rest of it you'll see on the screen in a moment, these were the men who were endorsing and defending and arguing against Jesus that Moses lowered the law. And you could divorce your wife for any reason you want. It didn't have to be adultery. It could be less than adultery. That's their belief. That's what they're arguing for. And that's what they're trying to trap Jesus into saying is not true. They think they've got Moses on their side, that you don't have to have adultery to divorce a wife. You could ditch her for any reason you want. They're going to argue this with Jesus. So in verse 4, he answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Does this precede Jesus' day? Sure. Does it precede Moses' day? Yeah. Precede Abraham? Sure. Does it go all the way back to the garden? Well, yeah. And nothing's changed in marital relationships all the way back to the garden. Haven't you read that? Men and women, still men and women. Still works the same way. 5, 6. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. Now, big deal here. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. At this point, there are two forks in the road. The passage says, let no man separate. Some say what this means is, no man can separate. It's impossible. That cannot be done. Jesus is saying this. What therefore God has joined together, it's not possible for you to separate. Or, it is possible, and you shouldn't. Those are the two choices. Now, I take the idea that God only forbids that which you could do, and He doesn't want you to. He forbids thievery because you can steal. He forbids covenant breaking because you can break covenants, so don't. He forbids a lot of things that you can do, and He forbids nothing that you're incapable of doing. If you can't do it, there isn't going to be a law against it, because you couldn't do it in the first place. So you have to choose. Is He stating, you know, what is tautology? You can't, but I'm going to tell you not to do it anyway. Or is He saying you could, but I don't want you to? Bill.
I once knew a preacher who I thought was a very wonderful man. And he took that even a step further. He said, even though a person who had been divorced and then had become a Christian and had their sins forgiven, if they got married, they were going to go into adultery.
That's right. That is one view that I used to hold as well. And you'll see people take it a lot of ways, steps further. There's quite a few among us today who teach that before you can baptize anybody, you must first investigate all their past marital relationships. Then you determine whether or not you think they had a right to marry somebody afterwards or not. And if they're in a marriage where they shouldn't be in this marriage, then you should not baptize them, and they won't, until you get rid of your current mate and commit the abomination that we just read in Deuteronomy 24. You got to go back to the first one. So there's a lot of steps that you could take as you go down making these choices. I'm just saying that Deuteronomy 24 is a case law. If this happens, then this can happen. Then over here, the Pharisees, they took this to be a license to divorce our wives for any reason at all. She doesn't have to be caught in nakedness at all. If she just burns the toast, was their famous example, I can divorce her. Because the certificate of divorce is a free pass out of marriage. Moses lowered the law. Used to be you couldn't divorce except for adultery. Now in Deuteronomy 24, he says you can divorce for anything you want, any reason at all. But not so with Matthew. They're testing. They want to defend that proposition. We want to divorce our wives for any reason at all. But he says, no, that hasn't been the case since Adam and Eve. There are no longer two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Stop that. Don't do that anymore. Verse 7. Well, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce? See, they're arguing. That can't be true. Because Moses gave her a certificate of divorce. We can separate. And God doesn't care. It's okay. Certificate of divorce. So they're arguing for divorce for any reason at all. Jesus is saying no. And then in verse 8, he responds, because of your hardness of heart, she finds no favor in your eyes. Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. Moses permitted these men who had no favor for their wife because of what? Because of a matter of nakedness. We have Jesus' inspired commentary on Deuteronomy 24. He hardened his heart toward her because he found nakedness in her, and because of that hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. You have a right to divorce an adulteress. And no man would divorce an adulterous woman if he didn't have a hard heart toward her. If he hadn't hardened his heart toward her, if she found favor in his eyes, he wouldn't divorce her. But she doesn't find favor in his eyes. He's hardened his heart against her. And that's because of the matter of nakedness. That's what Moses permitted. This is an inspired commentary on Deuteronomy 24. It is not an argument against Deuteronomy 24. It is not a suspension, abrogation, or annulment of Deuteronomy 24. It in no way changes Deuteronomy 24. These men didn't ask about what to do in Christianity. They didn't ask what to do under any law but that law. They cited that law. Jesus cited that law. He says, you're wrong. You may not divorce your wife for any reason at all. It has not been this way since the beginning. Maybe I haven't got there yet. From the beginning, it's not been this way. From the beginning, it's not been your way, this way, for any reason at all. From the beginning, Moses was only reiterating what was from the beginning. You can divorce your wife if she finds no favor because you found nakedness in her. That's the law.
I just wanted to go back to verse 3. It says the Pharisees were testing him.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the devil added a word in the garden to change what God's scripture said, the Pharisees took words out to make them do what?
That is absolutely what's happening. The certificate of divorce is to exist in one case only ever. What is that one case? You caught her in a matter of nakedness. That's why you get a certificate of divorce. That's why all this, you know, existed in this case. That's what Jesus said. One reason only. It's been that way since the garden. You men are wrong. From the garden, it has never been that you could divorce your wife for any reason at all. Whatever the way is that Jesus condemns here, it has never, ever been allowed since the garden. But Moses' law was the law and did allow something for the last 1,500 years. So he can't be saying Moses is the way that hasn't been from the beginning. Moses has been a way for the last 1,500 years, God's ordained way. We're looking for a way that has never been allowed going all the way back to the garden. What has never been allowed going back to the garden is that you could divorce your wife without her having committed adultery as listed in Leviticus. Now, running out of time still. Let me just get through these charts really quick. Here's Deuteronomy 24, finds no favor in his eyes. Matthew 19, 8 and 9, your hardness of heart. Those are equivalent expressions, a divine commentary. He found some indecency in her. Well, except for fornication, the indecency and the immorality, depending on your translation, is the nakedness in Deuteronomy 24 and the porneia in Matthew 19. And here's the list. I just want to put it up. 33 sexual sins are listed, with 10 of them death penalties. Nakedness is used 20 times in that list, and it never means burn the toast. It never means incompatibility. It never means anything less than a sexual sin ever in the law of Moses, save for the, you know, the spying out the land. Deuteronomy 24 is right here in the list. So, now we'll go ahead and throw it all open to you, but this is the law. They had it for 39 years. Now we got about 10 minutes. What do you see? What do you think? Any of those passages? Bob?
I personally find it odd that both of all of this that we've been talking about...
Bob, I can't.
I find it odd that all this that we've been talking about is written from the male point of view.
Yes.
And it seems like the male has the say as far as a divorce, writing of his divorce certificate and so on, and the wife has to deal with the consequences. Am I... Is that the way it was or is?
I believe that when Jesus in Matthew 10, or Mark 10, you know, in the other passages in the Gospels, beside the one where the big battle's going on with the Pharisees and all, but in the other Gospels, he reverses it so you now know it was always allowed both ways. A wife can divorce an adulterous husband, same way. That's certainly so. But you're absolutely right that it was written from the male viewpoint in the old law. That did not mean the female viewpoint was forbidden. And Jesus' comment on it shows that. Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
This is another idea, and it's probably way afield, but I was just wondering about all the wives that David and Solomon had. How can they be one flesh with multiple wives?
One flesh is a sexual union, which in 1 Corinthians 6 he says you can do with a prostitute. So whenever you have a sexual relationship with somebody, you're becoming one flesh with them. And so if you have multiple wives, every time you get together with them, you are one flesh. You don't become one flesh because you have a marriage certificate. You could do that with a harlot. You have no marriage legal stuff at all, but you're still one flesh with her in 1 Corinthians 6. Okay? Carol?
Another proof that the Pharisees had the wrong interpretation of the law was that when they brought the harlot in, or the woman caught in adultery, caught in the very act of adultery, that they didn't bring the man. They were inflating the value of men over women in their treatment of the law.
What Carol just said is so profoundly important. Jesus never argues with Moses. He never says Moses is wrong, Moses is too loose. He never argues with Moses, but he argues an awful lot with the Pharisees who have misunderstood Moses, twisted Moses, abused Moses, and made license to break covenant and throw away wives based on their false understanding of Moses. It's a wonderful, wonderful point. Let's never forget that. Jesus is a Jew teaching Jews how to be Jews under Moses' law. And if he ever violates that idea, then he disqualifies himself as our sacrifice. He said he wasn't going to annul a single one. He's still living under Moses' law. When people under Moses' law quote Moses' law, ask him about Moses' law, and he says, "You're abusing Moses' law. Stop it." Because Moses never allowed divorce for anything other than adultery. Savory, yeah.
Well, then how does this fit with 1 Corinthians 7? We need to merge that because we're in the Christian dispensation, not the Jewish.
Exactly. And I'll be finishing that up in another week or two in 1 Corinthians 7. And my point there in 1 Corinthians 7, again, is that no law ever changed. No law on marriage, divorce ever changed. 1 Corinthians teaches Christians the same thing Moses taught Jews, the same thing that Abraham taught his family, and the same thing the Gentiles were always under, and the same thing unbelievers are under. Marriage law is not specific to whether or not you're a Christian or whether or not you're a Jew. Marriage law is fundamentally human law. So it existed before there were Jews and Gentiles, while there were Jews and Gentiles, and when we don't have Gentiles anymore with Christians and non-Christians. Do non-Christians get married? Does God recognize the marriage between two atheists? Sure. Does God join atheists together in marriage? Well, sure. Do they become one flesh, those two atheists? Well, sure they do. And if they divorce their wife for less than adultery, what have they done? Violated Jesus' teaching and Moses, because they're one and the same. Okay, anybody else?
God, and I can't tell you where it comes from, but God is always the same. So you would expect His love to always be the same.
Carol, you got to be really careful with that argument. Okay, and I think we all of us make a mistake with that one. Yes, God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is that. But that does not mean that He could not tell the Jews that you can't eat certain foods, and if the Gentiles ate the same food, it would not be a sin for them, but it is a sin for the Jew. And then reverse Himself on foods. Okay, we spent a lot of time on this in our Leviticus class. God has had different laws, and He's had laws that did apply to Jews and did not apply to Gentiles, and vice versa. What I'm maintaining is none of those laws that could be specific and changeable were moral laws, like lying, murder, stealing, or covenant breaking. Marriage is the ultimate covenant. God reveres covenants. He never gives anybody a pass to break a covenant just because they want to. He's never done that. So He's still the same. But we do have to be very careful to distinguish what is clearly a moral constant as opposed to a dietary law, something like that. Okay? Anybody else? We're going to quit early. Okay, Carol?
We've talked about...
Carol, I can't hear.
We've talked about a person that is divorced because of adultery. And I totally agree with you. And I agree that that's what the law said. But when we...
You're saying that in Deuteronomy 24, the matter of nakedness is adultery.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm looking at Matthew 19 now.
Okay, Matthew 19, everybody.
Okay, so, but in verse 9, Jesus says, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality. Okay, that's somebody that, if there's a divorce, and it's not for that reason. It's not for sexual immorality. It's a divorce for whatever inconsequential thing. Then he goes on to say they can marry another, but if they do, they commit adultery.
Correct. It's exactly what he said. And that's what Moses said. It's what was true in the garden. Read your mind here a little bit, because I remember the argumentation of my own self. What I think is happening here that we miss is that these Pharisees have come to Jesus thinking they got a caveat, they got a get out of marriage free card up here. Jesus is saying, no, you don't. So, you cannot divorce your wife for anything other than adultery. If you do divorce your wife, and they would have, they've divorced her, but you divorce her just so you can go marry somebody else, and she didn't commit adultery, then I, God, am declaring you to be guilty of the same crime you would have been in if you just run off next door and shacked up with her.
They have divorced, and you said that if they're divorced, then they can remarry because they're divorced, but Jesus says if they're divorced and marry another, they commit.
A certificate of divorce is a certificate of divorce. If you get one for an illegal reason, which is any reason less than adultery, then God says you're committing a crime because you're abusing that certificate of divorce. He will not accept it. He says you're guilty of adultery just as if you never got that certificate.
So they're in sin.
They're in sin. He forbid them to divorce for any reason other than adultery. They could divorce, and they did divorce, and they were divorcing constantly for less than adultery.
So they're in sin.
Absolutely.
Okay. And now they want to come, they've changed their mind. They want to come and be baptized, but then they're living in sin. So we can just overlook that.
No, we don't. No, Jesus, Paul addressed it at great length in 1 Corinthians 7, and we haven't got to all that yet. That aspect of it is addressed in 1 Corinthians 7 at length. What is the phrase? Remain in the condition in which you are called.
Which I don't see that it is specific to this. The examples he gives are secular conditions.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because Deuteronomy 24 doesn't say a thing in the world about Christians being married to unbelievers. Aren't you Christians? 1 Corinthians 7, Saber pointed out, is the only place we can go. Jesus never said a word about Christians divorcing Christians. You know, Jesus doesn't deal with that. He's still under Moses' law. It takes Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 to tell us what to do if you're married to somebody and then you become a Christian but they don't. What should you do? It takes 1 Corinthians 7 to tell us if you've been married 16 times and now you want to repent and come to Christ. Do you have to get rid of your wife? What do you have to do? 1 Corinthians 7 tells us those things. Because Moses can't. He's not talking about Christians. He's talking about Jews. Jesus is a Jew giving an inspired commentary on Jewish law. Paul is a Christian telling us what Christians should do. So he can introduce, what do we do? Can we baptize somebody that's in a second or third marriage? Should we accept that second or third marriage? You can't find that in Jesus. You can find that in 1 Corinthians 7. Then we have Christians. Yes?
So if I get you right, someone comes in a second or third marriage, they want to be baptized, they understand why they need to be baptized, you baptize them. Then if you're suspicious that they had a divorce for any other reason other than nakedness, do you need then to counsel them that they need to ask for forgiveness for that?
Okay. I realize we're past time. Anybody needs to leave, just get up and leave. But let me say something that, again, I feel very passionately about. I will start questioning candidates for baptism about their previous marriages just as soon as you show me the passage where anybody in the Bible ever does. Where it was done for the 3,000 in Acts 2. You think there were no divorced and remarried people in the 3,000 in Acts 2? They were divorcing just as much as anybody else.
The reason you're baptized is to take away all of those sins, and it's not compartmentalized as to this one counts and this one doesn't and this one counts. So if you're baptized, you should be baptized of all your previous sins, and you just start anew.
Well, I think so, and I agree completely. All sin is forgiven in baptism. However, if these ideas about pre-existing marriages that you shouldn't have got into and you need to get out of, you know, is true, then there ought to be some place in the New Testament where we're taught to do that. Or somebody doesn't. And there are none. That's very important to me. There's not one example in your New Testament where anybody questions somebody else's divorce, tells them they got to get out of a marriage or go back to a previous mate before you can baptize them. What we do have is 18 verses in 1 Corinthians 7 that says, remain in the condition in which you are called, and the only condition under consideration is your marital condition. That's what the chapter's about. So we'll get to it. We haven't got to it yet, but we'll get to it, in fact, next week. Slavery is introduced in 1 Corinthians 7. I think we'll get to it on Sunday as an example of the marital condition. It's only brought up because we're discussing marriage, and it's an example.
As an example of a condition that you're not supposed to change.
You should remain in the condition in which you're called in a marital context. So he uses other examples where you also should remain in those conditions to show you should remain in every condition in which you were called. All conditions you find yourself in, you remain in those. Okay? They're leaving now.
Bob, hey, when you're prepping for your lesson on 1 Corinthians, would you take into consideration